One World Observatory.
Observatory, straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They're trying to answer questions about upward mobility in America.
A military strategist. It was profiled brilliantly by someone.
So I think if you could find the subculture of people.
With a kind of form of life on this planet that we haven't really seen before.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Madeleine L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time is one of the most beloved fantasy novels around, and it's maybe surprising that we've never before seen the story in movie theaters. But a big Hollywood version of A Wrinkle in Time finally comes out next month with a cast that includes Oprah Winfrey and Reese Witherspoon. And there's one other surprising thing about the film, its director, Ava DuVernay. DuVernay was hardly the obvious choice for a fantasy epic. She's best known for Selma, about the 1965 Civil Rights March. And she put out the documentary 13th about the prison system and its impact on Black America. And she's been making a TV series, Queen Sugar, about siblings who inherit a sugarcane farm in Louisiana. Ava DuVernay appeared at the New Yorker Festival in October with staff writer Jelani Cobb.
Thank you. Hi. Hey.
So we have been trying to get together to do this for a little while, and in terms of your shooting schedule and events and everything, but every year when we do this, people say, oh, who do you want to interview? I was like, I want to talk to Ava. Because you have done so much in such a short period of time. And there, I guess I just want to start at the kind of earliest part of it, because there is a narrative that's really interesting. There's a thing that I think about in terms of geography and how geography sometimes means more than just space. Like for James Baldwin to get from Harlem to downtown where the publishing houses were, that was more than just, you know, four stops on the 2 train. It was a whole lot more than just geography. And so you are a native Californian, you're born in Long Beach, and I think there's a distance between Long Beach and Hollywood that's probably akin to that. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how you first came to love film.
Yeah, I got into film because I had an artist in my family who no one recognized as an artist, never practiced art, but my aunt Denise Amanda Sexton had an artist's heart. And, you know, the family did not encourage her to do all of the things that she had in her heart. And so she went to nursing school, and so she became a nurse. And she worked the night shift at hospitals all around Southern California for decades so that she could leave her days open to live the life that she wanted to live and experience art. So she became a huge patron of the arts. And so early on, we would do things that, you know, most people in Compton weren't doing. My mother, who did not understand who I loved dearly, this amazing woman, was just like, oh, go with Denise to read white people books and go to white people concerts. So we would go do white people stuff. Book readings, you know what I mean? Or the play in downtown LA that seems so far from where we live. And so every weekend, every week after school, on one particular day when there was cheap matinees, we would go and see movies. I would go in one and she would go in another, or we would go together. If it was an R movie, I would see my own, but it was a constant diet of film. And it was a magical time because I fell in love with the images, but I'd also, as I think about it more deeply, it's because I got to spend time with her. And it was offered to me with such love that now it's really the love of my life, that experience and creating that experience for other people.
And so I knew you in a kind of previous part of your career when you owned... Yeah, when we first met.
How did we first meet?
We first met in Atlanta in like 2000. Well, this is really getting to be embarrassing.
No, I've just known you for so long that if someone asked me, when did you first meet Jelani, I would have probably said college. Like, what did we...
So you came to Atlanta But yeah. I remember you telling me that you were going to, you had a PR company that you, yeah. you know, founded and, yes. and ran, and you said that you were going to, we had a conversation once, and you said, yeah, I'm not going to be doing that anymore. I'm going into directing. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I had no idea that you were right. interested in film.
Right, right.
And then the next thing I see is like this documentary that you've done, My Mic Sounds Nice.
Oh, right.
Which is your first documentary on women in hip hop.
Yeah, it was the second film I ever made. It was the first film that anyone ever gave me any money to make. So the first documentary I made was a film called This Is the Life about, I need one person. Look, props. Come on. This is going underground, deep down. Yes, thank you. You saw it too? Okay, too. I like that movie. It was made by hand for $10,000, check to check. It was when I first was saying, gosh, can I make films? Can I try to do this? Never went to film school, didn't pick up a camera until I was 32. But it was really a lot of steps to try to test myself and test how much I can tolerate in an industry that really is not built for me. Mm-hmm. But it was a beautiful experience, and it's a good film if you can find it. It's nowhere. It's, you have it? Listen.
Oh.
Listen. Yes. Yeah, it's a good little film. It's everything's imperfectly made when you're just starting, and even now, you're just not quite sure how to put it together, but it has a lot of heart.
So I just want to know, at some point, we officially transitioned into Black Church, where it's just like audience participation, welcome.
Call and respond. Call and respond. You know it's going to happen.
We will be passing the collection plate. But you said, talk more about this. You said an industry that wasn't made for you. And so talk to me a little bit about this, about that process of kind of getting into a place that, as you say, was not made for you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I work in an industry, if we take the industry side of things, not the actual work that I do, but the industry that monetizes that work, is built. I work in an industry built on the back of the film A Birth of a Nation. That is the film that started the whole industry upon which the studio system and a real thought about, wow, you can create critical mass around a piece of work and a real kind of peeping game by the very beginnings of an industry at that time. I mean, it was an industry made by white men, for white men, to make things for white men. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that I would love someone to try to dispute that. I think it would be a lively conversation. I would clearly win the debate, hands down. Mm-hmm. Or I'd just stick Jelani on him and be like, let him know. And then, you know, just stand back. And so we could take him. But you know, this is what that industry was built upon. And so you have, you know, a century of work built on a framework that was flawed and that was exclusive to a certain kind of person and mindset. Mm-hmm. So I think the thing that made a difference for me in getting into the industry is I wasn't looking to get into the industry. Mm-hmm. So when I started, it wasn't an intention of one day I just want that Oscar. Can just get that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm thinking about Oscar. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to make my thing and tell my stories and just wanted to see if I could craft what I loved. The only piece of the puzzle where I interrogate that statement for myself is that I continually, every time, applied to Sundance and got rejected 8 times. Mm-hmm. So on Middle of Nowhere, when it did make it into Sundance, into dramatic competition, which is the big category, and ended up winning Best Director, that's when everything changed and I had to really think about participating in the industry. So I don't know, the way that I got into the industry was very progressive, very step-by-step, and also very independent. Mm-hmm. On those very early meetings with studios and things, I would sit in with the real thought in my head of like, kind of like, oh, this is an interesting exercise in human behavior. You know what I mean? And not with a lot of expectation. And so everything that happened, when I trace it back, has really just been, not flukes, but things that I really wasn't trying to control. Mm-hmm. I was just enjoying making my projects. I was enjoying my work.
You know, in the midst of this, I think one of the things that also kind of struck me was seeing your voice develop from project to project. Mm. And even kind of becoming increasingly distinctive. And there's a clip, this is from Selma, obviously, one of your more recent works, but there's a clip in this that I want to show and then talk about kind of what you did as a filmmaker in this.
Okay.
What are we doing, Ralphie?
We take it piece by piece, like we've been doing. We build the path as we came, rock by rock.
His cell is probably bugged.
It probably is. No, Lord.
They're gonna ruin me so they can ruin this movement. They are.
Look at the birds of the air. That they do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns. And yet your heavenly Father doth feed them. Are you not worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life?
Matthew 6, verse 27.
All right.
Yes, sir.
I haven't seen that in a long time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if, how the screen was or if you could see Dr. King's eyes or anything in there. It was a little dark, but when I look at that scene, I think of David Oyelowo and Coleman Domingo, the actors, and I think of Bradford Young, a cinematographer. Bradford.
That's what I was going to ask.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. Just talk about Brad. Bradford Young. Gosh, I don't want to even get emotional. I just talked to him this morning, like for 2 hours this morning, and we haven't talked in so long. Because I'm making A Wrinkle in Time, and he's just making this little thing called Star Wars. And he's been gone for like, that brother's been gone for 2 years, like making that. And I just miss him so much, and I see that, and I talk with him today, and I just feel emotional, because I remember that was our first day of shooting Selma. It was the first scene we did. And I remember we were talking about the lighting. I was like, look, it's an Alabama jail in the middle of the night in the dank, dark. I need it to look like the hull of a slave ship in there. Don't give me no fake, this is prison light, right? It was a horrible place where they put too many people in one cell. If at the top of the scene, you would see bodies all around. It was cold, it was no light, it was nowhere to go to the bathroom, we need to try to capture what it was. Just give me a little something through the window. Yet he's like, yeah. And when he turns out, you're not gonna see nothing but like just a little, maybe a little outline of the eye. I'm like, yeah, let's do that. I was like, yeah. But anyway, in this scene, this is the first day of dailies. So the studio gets what they call dailies, which is every day they see what you shot the night before. So they look at the dailies and they're like, yeah, it's dark. Did you want to see Dr. King's eyes at any point in the thing? We're like, yeah, no, we like it like this. And they're like, yeah, we think we've given you the money and we'd like to see his eyes in the thing. And so Brad's like, there's space in there. We can turn up the eyes, you know? So we take it into the color and we turn up the whites of his eyes and we do all these tricks to show them. And nothing else in the film is this dark, but it was very intentional that it feel like the space. Yeah,
but there's actually another thing about that clip, and I don't want to dwell on it for too long, because I know you only want to talk about Martin Luther King some of the time.
No, I don't.
Do you know what I liked about that scene, as the historian in me liked about that scene, was that we have been given this vision of MLK as this singular entity who's just radiating inspiration and power to all the people around. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's the pinnacle of this expression of freedom, a desire to be free, that stretches from 1619 up until he arrives.
Right.
And you inverted that. Like, yeah. And that's not the only time you did that in the film. Like, in many instances, you see King leaning, sometimes heavily, on the people around him and, you know, displaying self-doubt and not sure he can actually do what history is commanding him to do, and almost certainly can't do it without the other people around him.
Right. You know, I couldn't, as a black woman who was a you know, history buff and major, and my father is from Lowndes County, Alabama. Lowndes County is the count. My father, love him, miss him so much. Just recently passed. Between Selma and Montgomery is a county called Lowndes County. Between Selma and Montgomery, when they walked from Selma to the capital of Montgomery, they had to walk through Lowndes County. My father, 5 years old, was one of the kids standing out waving as Dr. King and the people walked by, the little country kids in the deep, deep rural South. My father's from there, and his daughter ends up making a film called Selma. So when I get the script and it doesn't have any, it's called Selma. Shouldn't there be some people from Selma in the movie, or no, just stay in the White House? Let's just get the people from Selma in the movie. And you can't have King. This isn't what King was. He was a man. A
human being.
He was a human being. Right. So all of those things that we put in, I'm so happy that you saw that in it. And some people who had just thought of him as the monument or the holiday now have a sense of him as a flesh and blood person. Human being. Yeah.
That's Ava DuVernay at the New Yorker Festival in 2017, speaking with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the New Yorker. More from DuVernay in a minute. She'll talk about why her upcoming film, A Wrinkle in Time, might be different than anything we've seen before. That's in a minute on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've just been hearing Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the magazine, in conversation with Ava DuVernay. She's best known as the director of Selma, and her adaptation of the fantasy novel A Wrinkle in Time comes out in March. DuVernay is also the creator of the TV series Queen Sugar, and it tells the story of three siblings who inherit a sugarcane farm.
He'd never expect us to be tied up to the land now that we're grown.
Tied up? You make it sound like a burden.
You know what I mean. We're just kids.
Yeah, I don't think Daddy would expect us to do this now.
He did. He told me that's what he wanted.
When?
Last week. Last month. All the time. Oh, so y'all think I'm lying?
No, but, Rob, come on. None of us knows a thing about running a farm.
I do. Me and Blue helped out Pop all the time.
Running a farm is a lot of hard work.
Man, come on. What's the harm in trying?
Jelani Cobb asked DuVernay about the show at the New Yorker Festival in 2017.
So you have now been distinguished in documentary, distinguished in feature film, and then Queen Sugar comes along.
Yeah. It's been, God, I love television. I just think, it's the elongated story. Usually as a filmmaker, I got 2 hours max. With a series, Queen Sugar, 13 episodes, 16 episodes a year. Like, we're writing right now the third year of this, this family in its third year. So to think about characters and situations in such a long arc, allowing you to see someone grow, and if you want to show a character who's formerly incarcerated, if you want to show a character who's battling addiction, you don't have to just do a very special episode of Queen Sugar and do it once. Like, you can see, how these issues and these personal problems affect and change and morph in people just like they do in our own families. And I think God, I'm just in love with it. So Queen Sugar is my baby. I love that show. I love everyone associated with it. And all the white people are like, what's Queen Sugar? That's not true. That's not fair. We have white people who watch Queen Sugar. Are there any white people out there who might have seen Queen Sugar? It's a lady, a beautiful blonde woman right in the middle, a brunette behind her. She knows. She knows Ralph Angel, too.
You are still doing focus groups, Ava. Pulling together a focus group here. The question I was actually trying to segue into, though, was about the number of directors, the number of female directors that you brought.
The number is all.
All. Yeah.
The number is every one of them. And for the second season, which we're in the middle of right now, and for the future seasons, that's what our the DNA of our show. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's in my view, it's righting a wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, someone came up to me. God, I probably shouldn't say this. Oh well. Someone came up to me and said, called me actually, a really lovely person, and said, you know, you may want to be careful with this because, you know, people can see it as discrimination, discriminating against men. And I said, took a deep breath on the phone, and I said, I would welcome that conversation. I said, I would welcome that lawsuit. I would welcome that whatever, because it exposes. I mean, you don't want me to go through all the shows that have had only men for decades upon decades upon decades, and no one raised a hand, no one sued for us, no one, you don't want to open the can. But if you want to open the can, we can do it. We can go there if you would like. It's up to y'all. But let's not. Let's just keep going forward and say that there are some shows that are using their, you know, this platform as a corrective measure to highlight and to incubate and to bring more women into the industry, an industry that has shut us out and continues to shut us out for far too long.
Yeah, I think we've had a conversation, given, you know, what the allegations about Harvey Weinstein look like. And I'm not going to ask you about that specifically, but I'll ask you in a general sense, like, how prevalent are those behaviors and how prevalent are those sorts of issues in the industry now? I think people thought of this as a kind of old Hollywood behavior, but...
Like casting couch?
Yeah,
kind of,
yeah.
I mean, it's not old. I think it exists whenever there are whenever there's power dynamics at play. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Someone is going to try to make a power play. And so if you have an industry that is run by men, for men, the content, I mean, literally 97% of directors of the top 1,000 grossing films over the past 10 years, 97%. 97% are men. That means almost everything you've seen at the movies over the last 10 years has been through the lens eye of a male director. And just to let you know what directors do, they make all the decisions about what you wear, how you sit, what you say, where the light is, who the camera favors. 97% men, right? 79% white. And so it's a sad thing, but it's across issues of men and women. It's across, you know, issues of black, white, brown. It's across issues of people with all kinds of different, you know, sexual and gender identity. And I mean, even when you look at the transgender community, and I apologize at the top if I don't use all the right terminology to describe things. I'm trying to learn a lot about the transgender community and trying to be supportive of rights for all. But I know that even like 5 years ago, I wasn't even thinking about it. I felt like a white person in that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to know this. You know what I mean? Like, it really is a way for people of color, I think. It's been a way for me to interrogate and understand the kind of white privilege when you think of it in terms of, you know, of the privilege that I enjoy, you know, as a heterosexual woman, right? I don't have to think about that, right? But somebody else has to think about that every single day. They can't even move in the world without thinking about it. And how we've changed our attitudes, our mind, through awareness, through recognition, through our own interrogation of what's right and what's wrong. If we could all just do that in a larger spectrum, we see examples of how it can work. Mm-hmm. You know, if we can't focus on or relate to the civil rights movement because it was so long ago, interrogate in your own minds the way that you've changed your mind about something that even 5 years ago you thought differently about. It's possible. You know what I mean? It's possible for us to change ourselves and in doing so change, you know,
the world.
Change the world. I mean, it's true. Yeah, it's true.
So I know folk would be very unhappy with me if we got out of here and didn't talk about Wrinkle in Time.
Oh, great.
And so we have a clip here that we're going to show, and then we can talk for
a
second.
Is it a trailer?
It's a trailer,
okay,
right.
Okay. I'm like, how'd you get a clip out of my editing room?
Okay. We smuggled a clip
in. I was gonna say, yes.
What if we are here for a reason? What if we are a part of something truly divine? Imagine 91 billion light years traveled like that.
Sweet dreams are made of this.
Your father has accomplished something extraordinary. Also dangerous. He's trapped by a darkness that's actively spreading throughout the universe. And the only one who can stop it is you. Be a warrior.
I'll try.
So, I mean, this is a really kind of impressive array of work. And how did you come to this story?
Yeah, no, it's interesting looking at that because we're really, really in the weeds on trying to finish the movie right now. And I'm in a place right now where it's, when I was talking to Bradford this morning, he said, how are you feeling about it? And I, for the first time out loud, I said, you know, I don't know. You know, I love it. You know, I feel something very deep in my gut when the Oprah's voice says, you know, there's a darkness in the world and the only one who can stop it, and smash cut to a black girl. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know? I don't know. I don't know if people are gonna feel that like I feel it. I don't know if the people who I wanna see it will come see it. I don't know if the people who have certain expectations of what the book was are gonna be interested in these different, I've got a lot of great feedback, but it is about a girl saving the world, and that girl is a girl of color. Mm-hmm. It's not shied away from, it is front and center. Like, she is hopping planets and flying and like saving the friggin' world. She's like saving the world. She's saving the world from darkness. And in the film, darkness is defined as the darkness within us, right? She's saving us from ourselves. It's deep. Like, the book is written by this woman named Madeleine L'Engle, published in 1963. She was rejected by 29 publishers. I was like, lady, in 1963, we don't know what all this is, but Mara, you know, are you Christian? Are you not Christian? Are you a communist? I mean, it's spirituality, it's social commentary, it's spectacle, it's like a crazy thing. And, you know, there's not a lot of women working on a studio level on fantasy and creating worlds and all of that. And I just feel like, you know, how much of this is going to be embraced? You're seeing worlds being built through the point of view of a black woman from Compton. So when I'm told, create a planet, my planet's going to look different from my white male counterpart's planet, who we've seen 97% of the time. And so you're used to seeing that. And is this going to be as palatable, as interesting, as intriguing? These are all questions that have not been, we've only barely begun to ask the question with Patty Jenkins' great work in Wonder Woman, right? What do worlds through a woman visionary's lens even look like? I don't know. I think it's probably, maybe like in 20 years, someone will pull it up as a cult classic. Like, maybe they'll wheel me out of my wheelchair and be like, this was good after all. You know what I mean? We were wrong at that time. But we'll see. And thank you all for coming. I really, really appreciate it. I appreciate it so much. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
David DuVernay at the New Yorker Festival in 2017, speaking with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening. Next week, don't miss the show, because we're going to be handing out the film industry's absolutely most coveted and glamorous awards, the Brodies. Only at the New Yorker Radio Hour. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Calla Leah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with special help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Hillary Leichter Griffin, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Tarina Endowment Fund.